This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Jetzt gibt's Cheez-It, ein neuer knuspriger Snack, der köstlich nach Käse schmeckt. Hol dir jetzt deine Packung im Handel und das Beste, du kannst sie einmal gratis testen. Wer will heute Abend den Cheez-It? Cheez-It, der Cheez-It. Jetzt zum Gratis-Testen. Teilnahme ab 18 Jahren. Kauf- und Kassenbon-Upload bis 30. Juni erforderlich. Nur solange der Vorrat reicht. Teilnahmebedingungen auf Aktionspackungen und auf cheezit-aktion.de.
Welcome to a new series of Lady Killers from BBC Radio 4 with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. Imagine you're young, skint and pregnant. The father of your child wants nothing to do with you. Today, if you live in lots of countries, you'll have options. But in Australia in the 1880s, the choices are pretty limited. There's shame and potential destitution if you go ahead with the pregnancy, or you could risk an illegal and potentially fatal backstreet abortion.
I was shown into a bedroom where she performed the operation. I've been in bed since I returned from Melbourne, having the fear of death before me and having no hope of recovery.
It wasn't hard to find an abortionist because they placed coded adverts in the classified columns of the newspapers.
Mrs. J.H. Robertson, duly qualified and certified midwife, accommodates ladies.
Elizabeth Taylor, practical midwife, ladies' nurse. Consulted 10 to 4. 1 Waxman's Cottages, Bridge Street, Richmond.
I'm Lucy Worsley, and I'm joined by a crack team of investigators to take a look, a feminist look actually, at the wild and unthinkable crimes committed by lady killers in Britain, North America, and Australia. We hear their words, their voices, and we ask, what drove these ordinary women to do these extraordinary things? What do these lady killers tell us about the world they lived in and about women's lives in the past? And what might they also tell us about our own lives today? One young woman who answers the advert placed by Mrs. Elizabeth Taylor, that practical midwife, is a 21-year-old unmarried actress called Julia Warburton. On the 19th of July, 1886, Julia goes to see Mrs. Taylor in Richmond, Melbourne, and Mrs. Taylor performs an illegal operation. 2 days later, suffering from blood poisoning, Julia Warburton is dying. Julia's mother demands that Mrs. Taylor call a doctor, but Mrs. Taylor insists she'll only have one particular doctor, Dr. Peacock. They seem to have some sort of an understanding. But by the time he arrives, Julia is dead. Mrs. Taylor hopes that he'll do her a favour by issuing a death certificate, stating that Julia has died of a ruptured liver. But as he reveals at the inquest into Julia's death, he wasn't as cooperative as Mrs. Taylor had hoped.
I went into the bedroom where the girl lay, which was in darkness, and Mrs. Taylor came in and said, "It's me, Doctor. I'm in trouble. The girl is just dead. Can't you give a certificate?" I said I could not possibly do so. I would be liable to be imprisoned if I did.
The inquest jury, after half an hour's deliberation, finds that Julia died from shock and hemorrhaging caused by a criminal abortion, and that Elizabeth Taylor is guilty of willful murder. Elizabeth Taylor is committed for trial and indicted for murder. If found guilty, she faces the death penalty. Abortion. It's a divisive, emotive subject, isn't it? A painful decision, a last resort. Joining me to discuss the abortionist Elizabeth Taylor is Deborah Frances White, who's known for the podcast The Guilty Feminist. Deborah's also an author, an award-winning comedian, and an Australian. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you so much for having me, Lucy.
Now, Deborah, you've campaigned for women's rights.
Yes.
And this is a hot topic just now, isn't it? With the overthrow of Roe versus Wade in the US. That's the US Supreme Court opening the door for individual states to ban or restrict a woman's ability to get an abortion. Some Americans, Deva, would claim that the rights of the unborn child should take priority over women's rights.
Roe versus Wade feels like a kind of watershed moment. In terms of feminism, it's shocking, but I feel like we are forgetting there are human beings in the middle of this. No one should be forced to be pregnant if they don't want to be. In my state in Australia, in Queensland, abortion wasn't decriminalised till 1986. So I'm adopted, Lucy, but because abortion was illegal, I was adopted out and my birth mother had to go and live in an unmarried mother's home so the neighbours wouldn't see she was showing. I've never asked her because I do not wish to traumatise her further, but I suspect that I might not be here if the kind of feminist legislation that I advocate for was available. And so my whole existence is a paradox, honestly. But I'm still going to advocate for it because no one should have to be pregnant when they don't wish to be.
Thank you. You have brought nuance and paradox to the party already. We're also joined today by our resident historian, another Australian, Ros Crone, Professor of History at the Open University. Welcome, Ros.
Hello, Lucy.
Now, Ros, in the late 19th century, how could women control their fertility? What were the options?
Methods such as condoms, increasingly made from rubber, also diaphragms and contraceptive sponges were becoming available at the end of the century. And douching with alcohol or vinegar was also a thing, but makes me feel quite squeamish. But let's be clear, artificial contraception wasn't available to everyone and it wasn't very reliable. And it's really important to remember that at this time, terminating unwanted pregnancies was also a form of birth control. This was done firstly through traditional ideas about drinking gin or having a hot bath to bring on an early miscarriage. And later in the 19th century, pills were widely advertised to deal with so-called obstructions and irregularities. The last resort, of course, was surgical abortion. Now, at the time of our case, in the 1880s, there was an outcry about birth control because in places like Britain and Australia, people were worried about the decline in population and in family size. In Australia especially, there was a big panic. That's the whole idea of populate or perish.
That's not what's going on in America at the moment, is it?
I would suggest it is.
Oh, really?
Because I think there are quite a lot of white supremacists in America who are saying, the racial population of America is changing. You know, the Hispanic population's getting bigger, the black population's getting bigger, and we're panicked that white people will at some mythical point in the future become a minority. So what they're doing is they're trying to force white working class disenfranchised people to have more babies to populate America so that America remains a white country and that the whiteness in America grows. It's absolutely absurd, but there we are. It is a Victorian value.
That is a very interesting parallel between 1880s Australia and modern America. Ros, what do we know about the woman we're talking about today, Elizabeth Taylor?
Well, we know that Elizabeth was born in 1844 in Manchester, and I've been able to locate her and her family in the immigration records.
Ooh.
So I brought those along today to show you. So what I have here, this is a passenger list from the Patterdale. That's a ship that left Liverpool in late August 1872 and arrived in Melbourne in November the same year, 1872. So you see John Taylor, age 34, and his wife Elizabeth Taylor, age 28, and their daughter Mary Taylor, age 7. And I have a mugshot of her from a bit later in her life. If you can see that there.
I'm looking at a picture of a woman in her 40s with rather a severe haircut, a severe expression on her face.
She looks serious. She looks sad. But you could imagine, if you took away the Victorian dress and put this into colour, her being a friend.
I asked Elizabeth Anya Petrivna, a curator with the National Trust of Australia, to go to where Elizabeth Taylor lived in Richmond, Melbourne, to find out what it was like when she arrived there off the boat from England in 1872.
I'm looking at the street directory, Sansa MacDougall, from 1885, which lists Elizabeth Taylor as a midwife. The directory would send representatives out once a year to Dornoch to gather info for the listings, and Taylor must have been at home when they called at Waxman's Cottages, now demolished, but just round the corner from here. Today, Richmond is a gentrified inner city suburb, but back then, the borough was home to both rich and poor. The wealthy lived on the hill, while the working classes had settled on the lower ground. Elizabeth Taylor arrived in Melbourne in 1872, just after the heyday of the Victorian gold rush, and when the city was on the cusp of a major urban boom which dominated the 1880s. It was a difficult place for women, described at the time as a white working man's paradise, and dominated by the consumption of vast quantities of alcohol. Many women started out in domestic service before being lured into factory work, and many women lived comfortable lives operating successful businesses, particularly in gendered industries such as dressmaking and millinery, servant procurement, as well as becoming lodging house operators and pub licensees. And some, like Elizabeth Taylor, set themselves up in the abortion business.
Foz, what was the legal situation in late 19th century Australia about abortion?
Well, essentially, the Australian colonies followed British law. The first law on abortion in England and Wales was Lord Ellenborough's Act of 1803, which punished abortion of an early fetus with a fine, but abortion at a later stage of pregnancy, specifically when the movement of a fetus could be felt, that was punishable by death. Legislation in the following decades removed the death penalty, but abortion at any stage carried a long prison sentence. Then, in 1861, the Offences Against the Person Act specifically criminalised the use of drugs or poisons and instruments as well to abort a fetus, either by the pregnant woman or by someone else, and this carried a maximum penalty of imprisonment for life. Of course, if something went wrong and the woman died, an abortionist could be facing a murder charge.
Now, Ros, Elizabeth Taylor's advert in the newspaper describes her as a practical midwife and ladies' nurse. Do you think that means that she's had any medical training, as we'd understand it?
Well, it might. So if we're thinking about the kind of abortion industry at this time, at one end, we actually have doctors. And Dr. Samuel Peacock, who we heard from earlier here, he was also known as a doctor who would perform abortionists, quite well known, in fact. Next, there were nurses and midwives, and they had businesses where they also dealt with pregnant women more generally, and they would also offer abortions. Now, often they did have good medical training, and some contemporaries at the time said, honestly, if they were a woman, they would prefer to go to one of these registered nurses and midwives rather than a doctor, because they would probably get better care and empathy from the woman. We have some insights, thanks to this case, about how much she's charging. It's suggested that she's charging about £20 for an abortion, which is a lot of money.
Oh, my God.
It's a lot of money.
What's that in today's money?
Well, back then, it's almost a year's wages for a domestic servant. So that's a lot of money.
How did anyone afford it?
I think she's probably offering some cut price deals to some people. I don't think she always charges £20, to be honest.
Now, interestingly, this case of Julia Warburton isn't the first time that Elizabeth Taylor's been implicated in the deaths of young women who found their way to her house in Richmond. One witness at Julia Warburton's inquest reports a brief but revealing conversation with Mrs. Taylor.
Aren't you Mrs. Taylor, who was connected to that Richmond affair?
Yes, I am always in trouble.
Now, that Richmond affair refers to one of Mrs. Taylor's previous appearances in court. It was in 1882, after the death of a woman called Margaret Robertson. She died of gangrene after an abortion, and her husband reported Mrs. Taylor to the police. A year later, Mrs. Taylor was back in court again, this time after the death of Florence Wadilove, who was just 15. And then 2 years after that, Mrs. Taylor was prosecuted for the death of Ada Latham, who was 21. Now, astonishingly, after all of these previous court cases, Mrs. Taylor had walked away free. But this time with Julia Warburton, she's in real trouble. She's on a murder charge, and she's facing the death penalty. was. It seems that Elizabeth Taylor's playing sort of cat and mouse with the legal system. How she got away with this?
Yeah, I mean, what you've got to remember that despite all this legislation criminalising abortion in this period, indictments for abortion are actually very rare. Police were very ill-equipped to investigate suspected abortions, and also they had to rely on the evidence of the woman on which the abortion had been performed. And there were very few women who were prepared to give evidence because they left themselves open.
Is it also true that people in the community are saying there are things we should turn a blind eye to, and those include terminations?
That's exactly right. It's often only when a death occurs that an abortionist really comes before the courts.
Deborah, your work campaigning for people to have better access to abortion, has that taken you into this world of people who provide illegal abortion?
Yeah, I have a podcast which really just shines a light on the work that activists on the ground are doing. I recently became very interested in a group of underground women in America in the 60s and 70s who were, first of all, helping women access doctors and then learning to do abortions themselves. So, yes, I'm always intrigued by the way the sisterhood will come together and by the way that women will find a way. And if we do not wish to be pregnant or we cannot afford to be pregnant, we will find a way. At the moment, there seems to be this idea that if we ban it, it will be gone. No, if we ban it, it will be the same. It will just be illegal and women will die. That is the only difference. Women weren't campaigning for it because they wanted it and it wasn't available. They were campaigning for it so that women wouldn't die.
Now, someone who has seen a lot of Mrs. Elizabeth Taylor over the years is Dr. Richard Yule. He is Melbourne's long-serving coroner, and Mrs. Taylor just keeps popping up in his court. But his view is that the women seeking out clinics like Mrs. Taylor's aren't driven to it by the strictness of anti-abortion laws or the stigma of being an unmarried mother. He thinks it's down to sexual immorality. The goings-on, as he puts it, in Melbourne's open gardens and parks and our free and easy beaches. You Australians, huh?
Go, if you will, to Fitzroy Gardens, St Kilda Beach, Williamstown Beach, and the other many places of resort. And what do you see? Couples lying in complacent, luxurious ease on the ground. This outrageous behaviour is not confined to the lower classes, but on through the middle classes to the highest in the land.
But Dr. Yule has a solution.
I suggest that all women must immediately register a pregnancy or face a punishment of 2 years in prison. This would enable police officers to visit the unfortunate one and inquire what had become of the child. This is the only feasible solution I can see.
So he's saying, Deborah, that the problem is the sexual depravity of the women in the 1880s in Australia. But that's... Do you think people still believe that in this world we live in today?
I mean, shock and horror, the women have been blamed. Yeah, I still think that there is an idea that women should not have multiple sexual partners. There is still a disparity in what we accept from a man and what we accept from a woman.
Dr. Yule's solution is to police, to control women's bodies by getting them to register a pregnancy. Are we confident in saying that sort of thing wouldn't happen today?
Having to register a pregnancy so then we can follow you and track you in an Orwellian way is quite scary. And that's why a lot of women in America are currently coming off these period apps. So there are apps that can track your menstrual cycle. And if you have to put your data in, they can say, hold on a minute, you've skipped this period. And now where's your pregnancy? And so women are coming off those in droves.
Yes.
So they don't want that data to be used against them. And that's a scary situation, isn't it? That feels like you're in a police state when you're worried about someone tracking your period.
Let's hear what happens with Mrs. Taylor next. Mrs. Taylor's trial for the murder of Julia Warburton takes place in late August 1886. We don't hear her voice because she hires some very expensive lawyers who tell her to keep quiet and let them do the talking. They argue that Julia Warburton had taken drugs to kill the fetus and that Mrs. Taylor was merely doing her job as a midwife in trying to remove it. And the operation went wrong. After a retrial, she's found guilty of manslaughter rather than murder, and she's sentenced to 2 years in prison. Mrs. Taylor serves her sentence, is released, and guess what? She's back in business. Her adverts are straight back into the papers.
Mrs. Taylor, Akishus. Ladies consulted free.
Her reputation spreads beyond Melbourne. In June 1891, she's indicted for the murder of Nellie Carter from Ballan, which is 60 miles away. On her deathbed, Nellie makes a devastating statement.
I, Nellie Carter, having the fear of death before me and having no hope of recovery, make the following statement on oath. I went to Mrs. Taylor's about 4:15. I went alone. On arrival at Mrs. Taylor's, I was shown into a bedroom where she performed the operation. After that, she gave me some brandy and water. I then left her house to catch the express train to Ballan. I paid Mrs. Taylor £10 that day the operation was performed.
Poor Nellie. Mm. This time, Mrs. Taylor is found guilty of murder and is sentenced to death. But a higher court reduces the sentence to imprisonment. It's a long stretch this time, 15 years with hard labour. Back in Melbourne, curator Elizabeth Anya Petrivna went to the old jail to find out what it might have been like for prisoners like Mrs. Taylor.
I'm in a cell in the old jail. It's about 2.5 metres long and 1.5 metres wide, and it's furnished with a table and straw mattress. Prisoners convicted of murder would usually be held in solitary confinement. This sort of cell would have been very familiar to Elizabeth Taylor. At that time, most of the women were serving short sentences for offences including soliciting, drunkenness, obscene language, insulting behaviour and vagrancy, a catch-all term which included sex work. Many women entered prison filthy and in poor health. Elizabeth Taylor was twice sentenced to hard labour, which probably meant working in the prison laundry. It's likely that she also worked in the kitchen and sewed inmates' uniforms, the usual work of women prisoners. I've got here the fascinating diary of John Castillo, the governor in the 1870s. Castillo focuses many of his more detailed diary entries on extreme, violent and often antisocial behaviour of women pushed to their limit. He writes about these encounters with female prisoners with puzzlement, their behaviour being so far outside his experience and understanding of women that they were, to him, a complete aberration.
Deborah, what's the situation about abortion in Australia today?
It's legal, Lucy. It's been fully decriminalised in all states and territories. South Australia, it was only legalised in 2022. If any of our British listeners are thinking, well, that's outrageous, 2022, please be aware, it has not been decriminalised in the UK. We are currently in a situation where you have to go and see two doctors and they have to go, oh, yes, this would not be in the interest of the mother or the parent, so yes, you can have one. It's not decriminalised here. It is accessible here. It's effectively decriminalised, but it isn't, and we're still fighting for that. So South Australia fought that particular argument in 2022 and won. Hopefully we will here too.
Wow. I was not aware of that little wrinkle in our beautiful canopy of British law.
Yeah. It's kind of more than a wrinkle because it says something about women being in charge of their own bodies. In, you know, I can't even say what goes on in my own uterus on a cellular level.
Mrs. Taylor makes one last appearance in court in Melbourne in 1898 in connection with a young woman who had an abortion that went wrong and then took her own life. She wasn't found guilty, but the judge, Justice Holroyd, is clearly pretty fed up with her.
You are an exceedingly unfortunate and very indiscreet woman. You know what I mean. You can go.
Mrs. Taylor's adverts now disappear from the Melbourne newspapers. Looks like the end of her career. But get this. 10 years later, a young woman called Lily Turner dies after an abortion in Perth. It had been done by a midwife calling herself Nurse Piers. And Nurse Piers is revealed to be, you guessed it, Elizabeth Taylor. Nearly 25 years after her first prosecution, she's once again facing a potential death sentence for murder. She's convicted of manslaughter, though, which means 7 years in prison. As Elizabeth Taylor's now 61, for her it's effectively a death sentence. And yes, 1 year into her sentence, suffering from a skin disease, she dies in September 1909. Foz, what do you think Mrs. Taylor's motives might have been? Clearly this is something very important in her life.
Deep down, I think she was actually quite good at her job. I think what we see are the kind of the terrible accidents where something did go wrong and she wasn't able to get help quickly enough for the women. I think she probably helped hundreds of women.
That we don't know about.
That we don't know about.
Isn't it interesting, though, that coming to the records of her life, we've really had to read between the lines to make that conclusion about her? Deborah, what do you take away from the story of Elizabeth Taylor?
I think the evidence is she was caught once, did hard time, came out, did it again. I think if this was just a quick buck, she wouldn't have done it again. She would have been like, it's not worth it now. I'll do less well-paid, regular nursing. The fact that she risked capital punishment and risked her own life to give abortions to women in her community tells me she was a feminist, an activist, and a medic that Australia should be proud of, because I am sure she was a great service to her community. And if only she'd had more help, more backup, you know, things would have been so different. And I hope the Australian government issue her an official pardon and apology.
Lady Killers is supposed to be a show about murderesses, but having learnt about Mrs. Elizabeth Taylor, it strikes me that she's almost the opposite of that. She was somebody who was perhaps trying to save life. Somebody whom lots of women might be glad to take the services of when needed. I'm also really struck by how everybody has views on abortion. The state does, the legal system does, the newspapers do. But the views of the people to whom abortion matters most, pregnant women, as we've learned from the difficulties of the evidence in this case, well, these are voices that it's very hard to hear. Well, a huge thank you to Deborah Francis-White, Roz Crone, and Elizabeth Anya Petrivna. Next time on Lady Killers, we're heading to Scotland, specifically to Edinburgh, to meet Mary McKinnon, a brothel owner accused of stabbing one of her clients. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Jane Greenwood, and the readers are Susan Dean, Claire Corbett, and Jonathan Keeble. Sound design is by Chris McLean, and the series producer is Julia Habel. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4.
My name is Jonathan Myerson, and 2 years ago we produced Nuremberg, a dramatised reconstruction of the trial of the major Nazi war criminals. Their crimes were indisputable, but one mystery remained. How did this group of unremarkable men come to rule all of Germany? Our new podcast, Nazis, The Road to Power, unravels this improbable story in 16 episodes, starring Tom Mothersdale, Derek Jacobi, Alexander Vlahos, Toby Stevens, and Laura Donnelly. It remains a lesson for us all. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.